WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. An IT specialist at John Jenkins Elementary School in Woodbridge is arrested and charged with sexually assaulting 4 8-year-old girls. Prince William County Police say 33-year-old Jonathan Skosik inappropriately touched the girls while they were in his office between March and April of this year. He's charged with 4 counts of sexual assault and 4 counts of indecent liberties by a custodian. A teenage girl is flown to the hospital last night after being shot at a carnival at Garfield High School in Woodbridge. Prince William County Police haven't said who she is or given her age. The Rolling Stones sing, "You can't always get what you want," and that even applies to the world's richest man.
Twitter is attempting to make itself too expensive for Elon Musk to buy. On Friday, the social media company's board unanimously decided to adopt what's known as the poison pill defense as a way to prevent Musk from buying Twitter and taking it private. However, it really only offers protection for the next year and kicks in if Musk increases his shares of the company to 15%. Right now, he owns 9%. Should Musk hit that 15% threshold, then stockholders not named Elon Musk could then purchase stock at a discount. Musk has proposed to buy the company for $43 billion.
Fox's Alicia Acuna. If you live in Maryland, you may want to fill up your gas tank today. It's the last day of Maryland's 30-day gas sales tax holiday. The price per gallon could jump around 36 cents tomorrow. Comptroller Peter Francho pushed for a 90-day gas sales tax holiday.
It's a tragedy that it's being prematurely cut off. The governor was willing to do 90 days. I was strongly recommending 90 days.
Democrats in the state legislature voted down a proposal to extend the tax holiday, saying it would take money out of the state's transportation trust fund, which is used to fix roads. If you're a fan of the Outer Banks, you know about the wild horses on the beach. Now we're hearing a foal has died.
The Corolla Wild Horse Fund says a foal named Charlie was seen on camera walking near his mom last week and seemed completely fine. Suddenly he lay down, and about 10 minutes later, he died. Charlie was the first foal born this spring season in Corolla. The group says his parents and brothers are okay and behaving normally, though they were very distressed by his sudden loss. Rachel Sutherland on WMAL and WMAL.com.
WMAL Sports. The Nats beat the Pirates 7-2. Tonight, the Caps play the Canadiens at 7. And NBA playoffs tip off today.
The Utah Jazz and Dallas Mavericks will do the honors of opening the first round of the NBA playoffs. The Mavs going without star forward Luka Doncic as he recovers from a calf strain. Game 1 in that best of 7 tips off at 1 p.m. Then at 3:30, the Minnesota Timberwolves, fresh off a play-in win, will take on the Memphis Grizzlies. Then it's the Toronto Raptors squaring off against the Philadelphia 76ers in the first Eastern Conference game of the playoffs. Tip off set for 6 p.m. And at 8:30, the Denver Nuggets will take on the Golden State Warriors. The Warriors listing Steph Curry as probable to return from a foot strain and bone bruise that has sidelined him since last month. Matt Napolitano, Fox News.
Traffic and weather next on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Traffic and weather on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Around the Beltway, both in Virginia and in Maryland, you're not tapping the brakes on the inner loop or on the outer loop. No crashes or construction. In Virginia on 66, eastbound and westbound lanes are clear. 95 in Virginia, no delays between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, north and south. In Montgomery County on 270, all lanes are at the posted speed limit between the Beltway and Frederick. And traveling between the two Beltways in Maryland on the BW Parkway in 95, no delays have been reported there. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, cloudy, then isolated thunderstorms, a high of 73. Tonight, isolated thunderstorms and mostly clear, a low of 45. And Easter Sunday, a high of 55 and sunny. 59 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Now, on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
It is the Saturday Morning Update for Easter and Passover weekend. I'm Rick Fowler. John Gizzi is with us. He is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. And a happy Easter, John, to you and Colleen.
Happy Easter to you and happy Passover to others.
A move that has been talked about but actually now acted upon by the Republican National Committee planning to pull out of the presidential debate run by the commission. What is going on, John?
Well, this is called a negotiating tactic. It is not a withdrawal from the debate. Very simply, The Republican National Committee on Thursday unanimously endorsed a proposal by Chairman Ronna McDaniel, which said, in essence, that unless there is change within the debate format, the Republican nominee in 2024 will not participate, and there will not be participation in earlier debates for the nomination. Here's why. There were considerable complaints voiced by Chairman McDaniel that in 2020, President Trump was repeatedly interrupted by hostile moderators. In particular, never mentioned, but certainly an ominous presence, was Chris Wallace, then with Fox News, now with CNN. There have been other complaints as well. But even people who supported other candidates for the nomination agree that, as Republican co-chairman Tommy Hicks put it, we don't want a situation where our nominee debates the moderator as well as his opponent. In addition, there were also complaints that the debates last time started as early voting was all underway, so the calendar is going to have to be resolved. In any event, this is not a withdrawal from the debate, but simply the start of reorganizing the terms under which the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is bipartisan, conducts them. The Republican National Committee and its chairman want them to be truly bipartisan, and they have more than a year and a half to do it. One postscript to this. Chairman McDaniel's uncle, Senator Mitt Romney, called withdrawal from a debate absolutely nuts, leading many committee members to remind him that this is not a withdrawal. And as one person recalled Candy Crowley's role as moderating a debate between then-Republican nominee Romney and then-President Obama in 2012, he's the last person who should be defending these debates.
The head of a national committee, such as the Republican or Democratic National Committee, can be a pretty big deal, especially in a midterm election year. You had a conversation with the Republican National Chair, Ronna McDaniel, this week, and what did you learn in the conversation about her future?
She's undecided about running for an unprecedented fourth two-year term at the party helm. When I asked her point blank whether she would run again, she replied, let's see how the midterm elections go, and then I'll decide. If we don't meet expectations, I obviously won't be considered for another term. But if we do, well, we'll wait and see. She also added the personal postscript that personal reasons would enter into us, such as her family situation at the time. Now, one other thing to look at is that she has a very good relationship with former President Trump, someone whose supporters have become increasingly strong on the Republican Party's 168-member governing body. She is considered a top fundraiser, and Republicans unanimously got behind her in taking the new tactic that they did with presidential debates. She's pretty popular right now. We'll see how the elections turn out, and we'll see what Ronna McDaniel does then.
New York politics got a little more interesting this week. We saw one crooked governor step down. Now you've got a crooked lieutenant governor stepping down. Tell us the latest on New York politics and what it means for the upcoming gubernatorial election.
Well, the appointed lieutenant governor, Brian Benjamin, had been considered a cinch for nomination to a full term running with Governor Kathy Hochul. Last week, all of that changed. Brian Benjamin was arrested in charges of a bribery case, and he promptly resigned as lieutenant governor and said he was not a candidate in the upcoming primary. The only problem is that the primary has had its filing deadline closed. That means that his name will still be on the ballot. There are two other opponents aligned with candidates opposing Governor Hochul. One is a self-styled progressive. The other is a socialist and uses the term. My guess is that the governor would not be comfortable with either of them. But under Empire State law, anyone who wins the nomination for lieutenant governor is on a ticket with the governor, much like the president and vice president. I might add that the near-certain Republican nominee, Lee Zeldin, has an impressive woman as his running mate, New York City Deputy Police Commissioner Allison Esposito, a 24-year veteran of the blue in the big city. So it will be an interesting race, and there will definitely be contrast between the number twos on the ticket.
Been a lot of questions recently, John, about the health of the California Senator, Dianne Feinstein, and some people speaking out anonymously didn't help her situation. What's the very latest there?
Some of these people who are said to be colleagues of the senior senator from California say Dianne Feinstein had trouble recalling their names, even though she's known all of them for years. The San Francisco Chronicle was reporting this. In addition, there is discussion in the Senate about her cognitive ability, and reportedly President Biden has voiced concern about it as well. All of this has led to speculation that at 88, and with 2 years left to go in her term, Dianne Feinstein will hang it up. But just the other day, she held a Zoom call with her hometown newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, and assured them she is fine, she knows everything going on, and she plans to serve out her term until 2024. Now remember, Dianne Feinstein, whatever one thinks of her politics, is a figure of history. The first woman elected mayor of San Francisco, the first major party woman nominee for governor of the Golden State, the first woman to be U.S. Senator from California, and the longest-serving senator from the state after 30 years. This is someone that politicians tread lightly around when they make suggestions that perhaps she should consider retirement. In the meantime, there's already speculation in Sacramento over whom Governor Gavin Newsom, also a Democrat, will name to succeed her.
We've seen a lot of the French President Emmanuel Macron and his attempts to get Vladimir Putin to cooperate with peace talks, but he's got his own political issues at home. What's next for him?
President Macron topped the field in a crowded race for president of France. He got roughly 27% of the vote. The runner-up who will face him in a runoff next Sunday is Marine Le Pen, leader of the Nationalist National Front Party, daughter of one of the most controversial figures in modern French politics, Jean-Marie Le Pen. She came in with a very strong 23.7% of the vote. Now the two will square off in a runoff that will determine who sits in the Elysee. Now, it should be noted that Marine Le Pen, 5 years ago, did get in the runoff, fared disastrously in the 1 2.5-hour debate that is held between the two major candidates for president, and lost by a margin of 2-1. Polls now show Macron a winner, but very, very narrowly, with many French saying they will not vote. A few things about Marine Le Pen. She borrowed more than $9 million from Russian banks and has said that she supports Vladimir Putin. When Putin launched the strike against Ukraine, however, she said she no longer backed him, that he's changed. She takes a strong, hard line on illegal immigrants, suggests that NATO and France part company, but is backed off on France leaving the European Union. A lot of French thinks prosperity comes from the euro. She recognizes these things that made her toxic in the past and has worked to detoxify her image. These days, she talks about inflation, the high cost of living, and is frequently photographed with people going to the mart. So we'll see if the new and improved Marine Le Pen can overturn President Macron, someone working to negotiate with Russia, but who many Frenchmen say doesn't pay enough attention to their problems. It'll be a cliffhanger.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. Have a great holiday, John.
Looking forward to it. A blessed Easter and a happy Passover to all.
It is 7:19. It is the Saturday morning update. We're going to talk to Dr. Bob Lahida next. You're hearing about another variant of Omicron spreading around the East Coast. We'll get to that next. Then we're back with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland in the 7:30 to 8 o'clock slot. Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
Around the Beltway, both in Virginia and in Maryland, you're not tapping the brakes on the inner loop or on the outer loop. No crashes or construction. In Virginia on 66, eastbound and westbound lanes are clear. 95 in Virginia, no delays between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, north and south. In Montgomery County on 270, all lanes are at the posted speed limit between the Beltway and Frederick. In traveling between the two Beltways in Maryland on the BW Parkway in 95, no delays have been reported there. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly cloudy skies for the majority of this Saturday. May break out to a period of sunshine through the afternoon. Highs today still very mild into the low in mid-70s. This will be ahead of a cold front. We'll shift through later on this afternoon and evening. Thinking anytime after 4, have the chance for some showers, even a couple rumbles of thunder with the cold front. That will come to an end later on this evening, clearing out overnight, lows back in the 40s by early Sunday morning. So, layer up if you're out the door for services early for Easter Sunday. Otherwise, partly sunny skies tomorrow, breezy at times, high temperatures into the mid-50s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
58 degrees in the nation's capital, 7:21, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. It is the Saturday morning update. A very happy Easter Passover weekend to you. And we want to thank Dr. Bob Lahida for joining us on a holiday weekend. Of course, we've been working with Dr. Lahida throughout the entire COVID-19 epidemic in the United States. And he is the director of St. Joseph's Institute for Autoimmune and Rheumatic Diseases. And he is the author of Immunity Strong. Dr. Lahida, thanks for being back with us.
Thanks, Rick. It's a pleasure to be with you.
On top of everything in New York happening this week, on Wednesday, health officials in the state said the two new Omicron variants are spreading rapidly across New York. So, Dr. Lahida, what do we need to know about those variants and how that might impact us throughout the Mid-Atlantic?
Well, the Omicron variants, at least the original Omicron variant, had 15 mutations, which made it immune evasive. And by that, I mean it took the vaccine some doing to really control the Omicron variant with its mutations, whereas the Delta variant, that was quite deadly in the beginning, had only two mutations. So it was vaccine susceptible. And that's a good thing because the Delta, as you know, and your listeners know, was very deadly. And it resulted in a lower respiratory infection with microclots in the lung, turning off a person's ability to breathe. And that's what caused so many deaths and had people in the ICUs crowding and in hospitals. But then now the Omicron comes along and it's largely upper respiratory, but it's 30 times more transmissible. This is the original Omicron. As far as the Omicron BA2.1 or BA2.12, we don't really know what the transmissibility of those are or what the severity is. We suspect from the current data that it is still an upper respiratory infection, meaning it infects the parts of your nose and your upper throat, and you get a tremendous sore throat, lots of congestion, loss of taste and smell, of course. But it really hasn't proven to be as deadly as the Delta variant, at least at this time. And, you know, it's all based on genomic analysis, which means to take the virus and look at the RNA genes in the viral particle, especially those in the area of the spike protein, which we can do very readily. So these subvariants are not a surprise. Actually, Rick, we talked a few weeks ago about the fact that many variants appear on a daily basis, most of which are discarded as being useless and not proliferating the way, say, a successful Omicron variant would. But the Omicron variant will, of course, develop mutations as it goes along, upregulated mutations.
So we had an apparent super spreader event among Washington's vaccinated elite, the gridiron dinner, and then there was an event at the White House, which could have also been a possibility for spread. Now, in the wake of those events, in the wake of the new variant, we're now talking about opening up the southern border and relaxing the restrictions from Title 42. And what might that mean from a health standpoint?
Well, that could be a catastrophe, and I'll tell you why. I've done a lot of thinking about this. Ethically, it doesn't seem to be a good idea, mainly because the largest mortality we're seeing in populations, at least in the northeastern areas, are among the Latinos and, of course, the African-American community. And it has probably a lot to do with immunogenetics of those ethnic groups. Caucasians, of course, suffer, but the large majority of the severe illnesses that we've seen in the New York area have been, of course, the African-American and the Latino population. So if you relax Title 42 and you have these people coming across the border by the tens of thousands, and we are, I'm sure, not capable of testing them all for COVID as they come across. And even if we did test them, there is that asymptomatic window where they may be infective but non-symptomatic. That could be a big problem. And I'm sure you can figure that one out. It's common sense. You know, you don't want a huge horde of unknown and undocumented immigrants coming in where the numbers of infected individuals is liable to be quite high. And that could really, if they're going to Washington, they're going to the New York City area, for example, it's going to infect large numbers of population. And it'll make multiple super spreader events occur.
In the wake of the exposure to many members of the administration, the White House press secretary said that the CDC says now that the definition of exposure is 15 minutes in close contact. Is that something we can really count on?
I think that's an arbitrary number. I would think 5 minutes in close contact would be more than enough to get a viral infection. Certainly, probably even less than that. But she's being very generous and saying 15 minutes of close exposure. And I guess if, you know, we were seeing when Nancy Pelosi got the virus, she was air kissing a number of people at this event. At least that's what I saw on my television set. And that's more than enough to get infected. If the person that your mouth and nose is next to is infected, you're going to be in deep trouble because you will be infected, no doubt about it. And I am sure it's just not taking 15 minutes. The virus has no time frame appended to it. It really likes to infect ASAP quickly and with great assiduousness. I mean, I just don't know how they came up with the 15-minute number.
We've had a little more time to learn a little more about the effectiveness of boosters. As you look at the choice of boosters today, you look at the new variants coming on, any choice that's better than the other, or would you say it's a toss-up between the three different shots?
Well, right now, Pfizer is making the most news by saying that the 5 to 11-year group of children should get a booster 6 months after their second shot. And this really leads to a six-fold increase in antibodies, neutralizing antibodies in the children. They're getting 10 micrograms instead of 30 micrograms, which adults get. Now, the 5 to 18-year age group of immunocompromised kids should also get boosters, but they should get boosters in general. And it's all Pfizer. Pfizer's applied for their emergency use authorization. Regarding Moderna and J&J, they have not, to my knowledge, talked about the 5 to 18 or 5 to 11 age group as far as children goes. What the government has said, what CDC has said, is that if you're over 50, you should get the second booster. Certainly, if you're over 75 or 80, you should definitely get the second booster because you're at great risk. Now, my read on this, and I'm asked this every day by patients, most of my patients are immunodeficient due to either disease or chemotherapy. They definitely should get the second booster because they are at extreme risk of getting severely ill and perhaps even dying from the Omicron variant, which, as you know, is still a COVID-19 virus. It's the very, very super spreader immune evasive variant that you can get even after vaccination. But you want to be as immune as possible. So it is a good idea to get a booster if you're over the age of 50. That's what Dr. Walensky is saying from the CDC, and I think that's good advice.
Dr. Bob Lajita, the author of Immunity Strong, Boost Your Body's Natural Healing Power and Live to 100, also the director of St. Joseph's Institute for Autoimmune and Rheumatic Diseases. Thank you so much, Dr. Lajita. Very much appreciated and very helpful.
Thanks, Rick. It's been a great pleasure.
7:30 News is next, then back with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
WMAL. News now.
WMAL News. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. Four adults arrested yesterday in connection with a dog napping at gunpoint were released hours after they were taken into custody. A judge decided not to file charges against them. Three teens were also arrested on charges of receiving stolen property after police found the Australian Shepherd puppy Pablo in an apartment in Northeast. No word on whether those charges will stick. A French bulldog named Bruno, stolen the same day, is still missing. The armed dog napping, a shooting and carjacking, all believed to have been committed by the same people on Wednesday, are part of a crime wave in D.C.
Citywide, robberies are up 58% and carjackings are up 47% compared to the same time last year.
Assistant Chief Morgan Kane notes teens have been involved in a number of crimes.
The behavior that our juveniles are engaged in, it's not fun, it's not funny.
She says she supports D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser's call for more officers on the streets. Rachel Sutherland on WMAL and WMAL.com.
Russia vowing to increase missile strikes on Ukraine's capital city, Kyiv.
The bodies of nearly 1,000 people have been discovered surrounding Ukraine's capital, and disturbingly, many of those people shot execution style, according to police. And also in the pummeled southern port city of Mariupol, Russian troops were seen digging up bodies, presumably to hide the evidence of their war crimes.
Fox's Matt Finn. WMAL Sports, the Nats beat the Pirates 7-2. Tonight, the Caps play the Canadiens. Up next, traffic and weather on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. WMAL traffic. Here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Here's your latest traffic update. Starting in Virginia on the Beltway, no delays on the inner loop or on the outer loop. In Fairfax County on 66, lanes are clear and wide open on the eastbound side and on the westbound side. On 95, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, lanes are at speed both northbound and southbound. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, no delays on the inner loop or on the outer loop in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. And in Montgomery County on 270, between the Beltway and Frederick, you're not tapping the brakes. Nothing in the road is going to slow you down, northbound or southbound. Now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, cloudy, a high of 73. Tonight, isolated thunderstorms, then mostly clear, a low of 45. And tomorrow, Easter Sunday, sunny, a high of 55. Right now, 59 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Saturday morning update, 7:37. I'm Rick Fowler. We're joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research, a former CIA-trained intelligence officer. Tony, good morning.
Hey, Rick. Good morning.
54 days into the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we have more weaponry going in, some of the heavier weaponry going in now on day 54. Russia claims that Ukraine is striking inside the border of Russia. Ukrainian government reporting this morning that they shot down four cruise missiles that had been targeting Lviv. And, of course, we saw the Russian ship that was sunk by two missiles from Ukraine. Would the heavy weaponry, maybe a little earlier than 54 days in, made a difference?
Oh, absolutely. And I think you and I have spoken about the fact that had these weapons gone in, had they been announced, had they been demonstrated by the Ukrainians, the deterrence that Biden claims he tried to use and wouldn't be effective would have been very effective. And let's remember, you know, part of this is Putin had to understand that power would be met with effective use of power. That's the only thing he understands. And I would argue that's part of why he didn't do anything during Trump's watch, is because Trump made a very big point of sending in lethal aid and showing how the United States was helping train them. So the fact is, I think that training has shown to be very effective. And again, let me be clear, this is not political. It's an observable fact. Obama did not provide lethal aid. Trump did. Trump provided the training. And therefore, had Biden jumped on the Trump bandwagon, there's a phrase for it.
Try that again.
So had he followed through and continued that, I don't think we'd be here today, because I think Putin has suffered some horrific losses, to include ships. This is the second ship they've sunk. While I don't think the Ukrainians are going to be able to muster sufficient combat power to push the Russians out, it's very clear they were going to continue to extract very heavy prices for anything the Russians do inside of Ukraine.
So Ukraine is claiming that 19 to 20,000 Russian soldiers have been killed. Reports that Ukraine is sending photographs of dead Russian soldiers to their mothers in Russia. What kind of psychological effect might this have inside Russia? We know that Putin's poll numbers have stayed up, and he's got a pretty good handle in controlling the media. But at some point, does the truth start to get out in Russia?
Well, this is very similar to their invasion of Afghanistan, except now with the information age, it's going to be much more rapid. The flash to bang of the reality of losses are going to be much more directly felt. Will it sway the public? I don't know, because most of the military he sent in so far are not conscripts. There have been some, but few, and they're volunteers. So it's kind of like, yeah, these are, you know, they volunteered for this, and I think there will be an effect, but they can always say these people volunteered to join the Russian military and serve. So I think at least for the next 2 to 3 months, when it's going to be most critical, there's not going to be a major effect. With that said, anytime you see the horrific results of war, it's got to have a psychological effect. And I think the more directed this can be, the more effective the information operation will be for the Ukrainians. But again, Rick, you know, as much as this, I think, will sway some, it will not muster sufficient critical mass to sway Putin or the overall massive approval that Putin is now enjoying within Russia.
So there are reports that the bodies of 900 civilians have been recovered in the Kyiv region. That happening just in the past several days. I guess the question is, with the atrocities, these war crimes that are being committed, you say that the number of these soldiers are volunteers. Do they randomly go out and, as individuals, commit these kinds of atrocities, or do they have to be ordered? I mean, I'm sure it varies from case to case, but in general, are these crimes being ordered, or are they just taking them on themselves to go out and do it themselves?
I don't think they're being ordered. With that said, I don't think they're being discouraged. I think it's one of those things where you're never going to find an order within the Russian military to kill civilians. With that said, Rick, it's been made very clear that civilians are a target and they're viable. So I think what you're going to see continuously is this Russian abuse. And I do believe, as we've spoken about several times, there are sufficient justification at this point to file for charges against Putin for war crimes. I think there's sufficient evidence of that. You don't have to have orders to file charges against someone. I think it's the overall leadership and the way they've been directed these troops to go do it, and it's accepted. It's not prevented. Our military would work its best to find and prevent, and if it happened, find and hold accountable people who commit war crimes. I don't think the Russians have the same standard.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, he is the host of the podcast at LondonCenter.org. What's on the show this week?
So one of the points that's come up this week, again, 2 weeks ago we talked about Putin becoming more desperate. We'll be talking about the potential use of nuclear weapons and trying to get our heads around the reality which he may do it. And that's something that we all have to consider. Zelensky said the same thing a couple days ago. I wouldn't bluff. I don't think Putin's bluffing about the potential use of tactical nukes. So there you go.
LondonCenter.org. Tony, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
7:44, Saturday morning update on WMAO. We'll talk to KT McFarland next. And what is the Biden strategy? What do we do? Well, we'll ask KT. That's next. But first, we're off to Al BD in the WMAO Traffic Center.
So far, so good on the Beltway, both in Virginia and in Maryland. Inner loop and outer loop are at speed. In Maryland on 270 between the Beltway and Frederick, no delays northbound and southbound. Also in Maryland between the two beltways on the BW Parkway in 95, I don't have any reports of anything to slow you down. In Virginia on 66, eastbound and westbound lanes are clear of construction and crashes. And on 95 in Virginia, you're not tapping the brakes between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. Lanes are clear both northbound and southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly cloudy skies for the majority of this Saturday. May break out to a period of sunshine through the afternoon. Highs today still very mild into the low and mid-70s. This will be ahead of a cold front that will shift through later on this afternoon and evening. Thinking anytime after 4, have the chance for some showers, even a couple rumbles of thunder with the cold front. That will come to an end later on this evening, clearing out overnight. Lows back in the 40s by early Sunday morning. So, layer up if you're out the door for services early for Easter Sunday. Otherwise, partly sunny skies tomorrow, breezy at times, high temperatures into the mid-50s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
58 degrees in the nation's capital at 7:46 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL. 7:50, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by KT McFarland, President Trump's Deputy National Security Advisor, a board member of the American Conservative Union, and author of the bestseller Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, always an honor to have you with us on WMAL.
Honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
And your opinion piece out this week at FoxNews.com, the choice Biden and the world faces in Ukraine. If we fail, Ukraine's fate is sealed. When this first began, KT, the president told us that he would impose sanctions and wait 30 days to see the impact. We're now 54 days in, KT. What does the president need to do now?
Well, I think there are two things. The only way to defeat Putin, ultimately, is militarily by the Ukrainians, not us, the Ukrainians defeating him on the battlefield, and secondly, economically, by reducing his income to the point where he can't afford to keep fighting. And the problem I have with the Biden administration is President Biden, there's a lot of virtue signaling going on, right? He says how the wonderful, brave, courageous Ukrainian people are fighting off evil Russia. But then why not give the Ukrainians the military weapons they need to do so? They're not asking us to fight. They just want to have the means to do so. Now, maybe if we give them the weapons they need, maybe they don't prevail, but at least they have a chance. The other thing is the virtue signaling about, oh, Putin is so evil, he's a war criminal, he's committing genocide. Oh, that's true, but what are you doing about it? You're just talking about it. What are you really doing about it? The sanctions are good as far as they go. But that doesn't mean that you're decreasing the revenue into Putin's coffers. Why? Because he may not sell the oil and natural gas to Europe, but he'll sell it to China. He's going to, in fact, probably make more money because the price of oil and natural gas is going up. The way to really stop him dead in his tracks is for the United States to start producing oil and natural gas and exporting it to Europe. What does that do? It has the added advantage of driving down the price of oil and natural gas. And that means Putin, whose only major source of income is the sale of oil and natural gas, his income falls in half if the price falls in half. And, you know, for 50 years, the Russians, before them the Soviet Union, every time the price of oil and natural gas was high, the Russians built up their military and fought proxy wars around the world and invaded their neighbors. When oil prices were low, the Russians hunkered down because they didn't have the income. Now, why is that? It's because in the U.S., our companies can make a profit if oil is about $50 a barrel, $40, $50, $60 a barrel, they'd be thrilled. In Russia, because the companies are all owned by the government, they pay for the government. So their prices need to be $80, above $80 a barrel, in order for them to not only pay for the government, but to do these adventures abroad, these invasions, these proxy wars, these military buildups. The price of oil is now at $100 a barrel, if not higher. The way to stop Putin is to stop giving him the money that's funding the war. And how do we do that? Only the United States can do that. And that's by producing our own energy. Replace Russia as a source of energy for the world.
And you mentioned a lot of talk. How would you envision the United States and our European allies and NATO, of course, taking the next step, maybe a stronger united front? It seems a lot of individual visits and a lot of individual action by the different NATO members, but a stronger unified, I don't want to say threat to Putin, but that's basically what we need to do, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, Putin assumed, he made a lot of very false, stupid assumptions that now seems in retrospect. He didn't think the Ukrainians would fight. He thought his military was terrific. He thought the war would be over and done within 3 days, maybe a week at the most, and he'd have a pro-Russian puppet government in Kyiv. That didn't happen. He also thought that it would drive the NATO members apart because the NATO response would be sort of lackluster or flimsy or uncoordinated. The opposite has happened, that the NATO countries, starting with Germany, said, uh-oh, this could be trouble for us. Maybe we better rearm. And then Sweden, historically a neutral country, Finland, always a demilitarized neutral country, they both want to join NATO now. So the NATO alliance has at least is taking the initial steps of being a more cohesive and muscular force, not to go to war with Putin, but to defend if Putin wants to come and invade them. I think what the president has, it would be so obvious and so easy, and it would fix so many things. That's probably why the Biden administration will never do it. But he could go to the American people and the Green Movement in his own party and say, look, we're putting the war on fossil fuels on hold, like Germany did. We're going to produce American oil and natural gas, clean American oil and natural gas. Not only are we going to be self-sufficient, not only is it going to fix inflation here at home, but it's going to drive the world price down and bankrupt Putin. Number two, go to the European allies and say, let's work together. You know, you did not want American oil and natural gas previously. You thought you'd buy it from Russia and that would guarantee your security. That's not worked. How about we help you to buy American stuff? We're going to build more liquefied natural gas export terminals in the U.S. and more import terminals in Europe. We're going to help you do that. We'll even pay for some of it. And then you can switch from the blackmail of Russian energy to clean, free, no strings attached American energy. And then the obvious to Putin is, look, we're going to continue to produce American oil and natural gas. The price of oil is never going to go above $60 a barrel. You can't afford to go to war if it's at $60 a barrel. So you better let's make a peace agreement right now. Not only would that stop Putin for now, but it would prevent him from building up and coming back in a couple of years' time.
K.T. McFarland, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. K.T., as always, thank you very much. And for those of you listening, K.T.'s opinion piece is at foxnews.com. If you have a little time over the holiday weekend, encourage you to check it out. Headline on it, The Choice Biden and the World Faces in Ukraine. K.T., thank you again, and have a wonderful Easter holiday.
Same to you. Thank you.
7:57, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Garden Sense is coming up after the 8 o'clock news.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.